Okay, so I hope everyone enjoyed their Yom Tov vacation. Just to first of all tell you what we are up to in terms of contemporary halacha. Today is a Chazara Shir. I don't think we'll get to everything that we've spoken about so far this semester, but certainly this will be the beginning of the Chazaras. Next week in Yitzhak Shem, Rav Ben Chaim will give us a shiur in terms of an overview of some Shechita and Trefos. That is the 24th of April. Then on May 1st, we have our field trip. Now, the field trip is very... it's exciting. You get to see a Shechita. Hopefully, we'll see real Nikur Hagid and Chelov this year, which is something that we're not always able to do. The place is not that large, so those fellows who are a little bit grossed out, for lack of a better expression, by watching animals being killed, etc., might want to take the week off, and I'll be understanding. Again, I want to make sure that those who come are able to see as clearly as possible. We might have to do it in two shifts when we're there, which might mean that the first chevra will have to wait a little bit. Next week, I hope to pass around a chart, a sign-in, to see who's interested in going, so we can approximate how many people it is, if we need one shift or two shifts, if we'll need two shifts. That's really the question in terms of the trip. After Rav Ben Chaim's May 1st shiur, Rabbi Ganak will give a shiur on May 8th, and then May 15th is the final. And the final, of course, will cover all the shiurim that we've had. In addition, those two simanim that we assigned in Yoredei, Simin Yud Tes and Chav Ches, basically some of the basics, some of the important dinim in Shechita and in Kisui Hadam, is what we will be requiring as the outside learning. You have to know it with the Mechaber Ramah, Shach, Taz, and Pesach Tshuva. That's basically what we need, and now we will begin the review of the semester. Question? Yud Tes and Chav Ches in Yerideya. Okay. We began the semester with two shiurim given by Rav Sabalovsky on the topic of mikvaos. And it's actually very relevant to begin this week, because this week is Parsha Shmini, no? And the Torah in Parsha Shmini says, Ach mayon uvar mikveh mayim yatahar. And in that pasuk, the Torah describes the basics of tahara. Right? There's mayon and bar mikveh mayim. There are two different categories. A mayon is a wellspring, and a bar mikveh mayim is a pit that contains gathered water. And the Gemara says that there are fundamental differences between a mayon and a bar mikveh mayim. First of all, a mayon is all bidei shamayim, completely bidei shamayim. A mikveh is something that's dug. That's one difference. Mayon, according to the Din D'Oraisa, doesn't require any shear. Mayon is metahir b'koshahu. Mikveh mayim, a bar mikveh mayim, what we'll call a mikveh, requires arba'im sa'ah, which is, the Gemara says, ama al ama berum gimel amos. It's the amount that an average person can fit into and will have his entire body covered. So there's a shear of arba'im sa'ah that's required by a mikveh. Again, there are certain detailed discussions in the Rishonim that are found in the Torah at the beginning of Simen Reish Aleph, but for our purposes, this is the fundamental difference between a mayon and a mikveh. Mayon is metaher bezochalin also. A mayon is metaher when the water is flowing. A mikveh is only metaher be'ashporen. Ashporen literally means a shever. It's a crack in the ground. A mikveh is only metaher when the water is gathered, when the water is not moving, and that's something that we'll return to in a few moments. Now, when is a ma'ayon required? When is a mikveh required? So ma'ayon is required in the Torah for a zav. A zav only is tahar in a ma'ayon. A mitzora, parts of taharas ha-mitzora, the Torah says that you need a ma'ayon. Efer para requires a mayon. There's a day in Rishonim that nisach hamayim, the water has to come from a mayon, it can't come from a mikveh. And then there's a famous shita that Rashi quotes from his Rebbeim that a zava, and most of our women today, all of our women today, we treat as zavos, right? The fellows in the Nidashir, we spend time on this. So Rashi quotes from his Rebbeim that a zava also requires a ma'ayon, and a mikveh is not good for a zava. This leads certain Hasidic communities to a practice that they dafka try to have a ma'ayon rather than a mikveh. And the if you go to Munsi and they tell you that you're taking a tour of the Munsi mikveh, it's a misnomer. In Munsi, they have a ma'ayon, not a mikveh. They dig down to make sure that they are touching natural groundwater, which is spring water, and that's what you are tovel in Munsi. You are not tovel in a mikveh. You're being tovel in a mayon. It solves certain halachic issues. It creates other issues in terms of expense. It's much more considerable. You have to dig down very far. One of the issues when we were learning mikvahs in the Kol HaElyon, so we went on a trip. Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Rosenzweig came. It was the only time Rabbi Rosenzweig ever came on the field trip, I think. And we went to look at the Munsi mikvah, so they explained to us that they had to dig down very deep to hit the groundwater. And the problem is that when you use a drill to go so far down, it generates a lot of friction. So therefore, you have to lubricate the drill bit. Well, there is a problem with lubricating the drill bit that they were worried that some of the water on the drill bit might go down and it might create a problem of mayim she'uvim, which is something that we'll discuss because the water is attached to the drill bit. So how do they solve the problem of mayim she'uvim? So effectively what they did is that they drilled with wine, not with water. So they got the cheapest wine that they could find. The Mishnah you speak about, there might not be a sort of she'uvim on yayin, and that's what they used to lubricate the bit when they did the drilling in the Munsi mikvah. So that was our field trip in the Kol HaElyon. So again, so the sheet of Rashi's Rebbeim is that a zava requires a ma'ayon. This is not accepted. It's beferish against the Tosefta in Megillah. In all the Ein Beins in Megillah, it says beferish not like that, but in certain Hasidic communities they try to be choshish for it. So let's talk about a mikvah. The major psul that comes up in mikvahos is the psul of mayim she'uvim. No, mayim she'uvim is water that was drawn bekeli. There's a machlokes harishonim, and seems to be a machlokes lahalacha in Shulchan Aruch also, whether the psul of she'uvim is a psul de'oraisa or a psul de'rabbanan. No, the Ramah is choshesh at the beginning of Reish Aleph that it's a psul de'oraisa. If I have mayim she'uvim, it's going to be puzzle. Everyone is maskim. That is talking about if it's rov she'uvim, if rov of the mikvah is drawn water. If I have a little bit of she'uvim in a mikvah and it's at the beginning of the mikvah, once I have 40 sa'ah, nothing will pass through the mikvah. If I have 40 sa'ah of kosher water, I could be memale bekate, if I could take big buckets and pour it in, and it's going to remain a kosher mikvah. But until the mikveh becomes kosher, so gimel lugin mayim she'uvim, Rabbi Savlosi showed with his water bottle, right? How big gimel lugin is, it's around 36 ounces, is gimel lugin will passel a mikveh betchila. That, everyone assumes, is a din d'rabbanan. The din d'oraisa, even according to Rambam, is if it's rov of she'uvim. Now, because of this concern of she'uvim, we basically don't allow you to just turn on the tap and establish a kosher mikvah, no? Because the issue is, the poskim say that there was a concern that the water, even though the water, when it's in the pipes are attached to the ground, and any hole that's in the pipes is inadvertent, and therefore it won't create a problem of she'uvim, but the water that goes through the meter will create a problem of she'uvim. That is the general assumption why it is nimnu v'gamru etzamore hora'a, that mei ha'ir is considered mayim she'uvim. To such an extent that in the hakdama of the sefer, there's a sefer mikveh mayim, that's two volumes with a lot of pictures. The pictures in Rabbi Savalovsky's mikveh charts came from that sefer. He told a story about trying to contact the mechaber, the sefer, and there's a certain lack of communication, but we have the pictures anyway, whatever it is. The fact is that in the hakdama to that sefer, Rav Wozner writes that, you know what, you in one context entertain the idea that that mei ha'ir might not be considered she'uvim. You should know that you can't even say it, hush, right? Don't say it at all, be quiet, don't even mention the idea. Right? So it's nimnu v'gomer that mei ha'ir is considered mayim she'uvim. There was a great tzaddik, however. Now, I'm not calling him a tzaddik. Rav Kook, Zichron Levracha, called him a tzaddik. So that means he was really a tzaddik. Rav Kook knew one when he saw one. There was a fellow, Reb David Miller, no? Not our mashgiach. There was a fellow, Reb David Miller, who was a plumber in Oakland, who never married. But he was very interested in being metaken that Jews should properly keep the inyan of Taharas HaMishpacha. And he noticed that most people, this is 1920s Oakland, most people weren't keeping Taharas HaMishpacha properly. So he decided that in order to allow Jews to keep Taharas HaMishpacha properly, he would come up with certain kulas in mikvahs, so that everyone would be able to have a mikvah in their own house. You could buy the book on Amazon for around $10. It's called The Sanctity of the Jew and the Eternity of the Jew. It has like a few different books. I actually bought one. It's a good thing to have. He has like a very interesting ways of disguising a mikvah. He says, oh, this is your living room. These are your kids playing in the living room, but here's your mikvah. And no one will notice that you have a mikvah. You have a mikvah over here. Now, how did he come up with doing this idea? So he had two big kulas. One kula that he has is that he's make on the size of our batim sa'ah. He says that there's a book that came out, the Aruch HaShulchan, and he's a terrible machmir. That's what he writes, and you should know that we have to be more meko. He has a big kula about how big 40 sa'ah is. Now, he needs that kula because he wants the average bathtub to be 40 sa'ah. Right? We assume 40 sa'ah is around 150 gallons. Our bathtubs, how big are our bathtubs? I have no idea. I never measured. Apparently it's smaller than 150 gallons. That's one of his kulas. Then his second kula is, he says, well, you're worried about mei ha'ir being she'uvim because of this... the meter, he gives you like five different arguments why it's not a problem, and that's why he tried to be makel on the mei ha'ir issue. Although Rav Kook calls him a tzaddik in that tshuva, it's a tshuva that Rav Kook wrote to Reb David Miller, right? He says he's a great tzaddik because he's trying to enable Jews to keep Taharas HaMishpacha properly, but he says you're messing up because it really is considered she'uvim. And then if you'll look, by the way, in Reb Nosson Kamenetsky's Haskama that he wrote on the Yitzchak Frank Dictionary, so Reb Nosson Kamenetsky quotes from his father, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky. Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky mentioned that there was a great tzaddik in Talmud Chacham who wanted to save all the Jews to enable them to keep Taharas HaMishpacha properly, but unfortunately he didn't know Dikduk well, and he messed up Lashon Zachar and Lashon Nekeva, and that's why he thought something was about Etzbaos, and it really was about Amos, and that's why he came with this very small shear for a mikvah, but it's dead wrong. So those are the two things I know about Reb David Miller's book, but even so, it's a really good book. So he's the one who felt that mei ha'ir is not considered she'uvim, but l'maisa, we consider mei ha'ir she'uvim. Fine. So how do we make a mikvah? So l'maisa, we use mei ha'ir in all of our mikvahs, no? We take a tap, we turn it on, we fill it up with water, but we assume that's going to be kosher, because we use the principle of hashaka. There's another principle of zriya that we'll get to, which basically is a way of making sure that even though the water I'm jumping into is water that came straight out of the tap, so it's going to be kosher. What is hashaka? So hashaka is either a lashon of kissing or it's a lashon of overflowing, whatever it is. Hashaka basically is that you have a hole. The hole has to be a technical size of a shfuferes hanur that comes up in Yevam. It's not a sugi of Shokas Yehu or something, right? The beginning of Yevam is a sugi about shfuferes hanur. So basically, it has to be two etzbaos that go around. That's the size of the hole. The minhag today is that the hole is a little bit larger. In all of our mikvahs, the hole's a little bit larger. Again, just where Choshesh won a slightly larger hole. Now, there is a Machlokes HaRishon, the Shachan Sivkot and Kuf Yud Beis quotes that Rabbeinu Yerucham felt that Hashaka has to be what's called Hashaka Tamidis. In other words, if I have one hole, that has kosher water, and then I have my other hole that has meha'ir. Where's the meha'ir? Isn't kosher, so the waters connect. Question, do the waters have to connect the entire time? When I jump into the mikvah, does the water have to be connected? Or do I say that, no, I could plug the hole up, and once the water touched, that's machshir the water. That's a chakir that Reb Chaim has, and it's a machlokas harishonim. Rabbi Yerucham felt that you need hashoka to meet this, that at the time I'm going into the mikvah, it has to be open. And the other Rishonim felt that the lumdus of Hashaka isn't a din of Chibor mikvah. So it isn't that Hashaka makes it like the smaller mikvah is connected to the bigger mikvah, as it were, or that the Pasul mikvah is connected to the Kasher mikvah and becomes part of the Kasher mikvah. Rather, the din of Hashaka is that it's morid the psul on the water. Just like the Gemara in Beitza on Daf Yud Ches has a concept that if I have mayim temeim, I can be metaher that water al yedei hashaka. So also hashaka is going to remove the psul of she'uvim from the water. Now, what we do is we have hashaka. Huh? It's machlokes harishonim. Rabbi Yerucham says you need hashaka to meet this, and every other rishon in the book basically disagrees with Rabbi Yerucham. But the shach and kuf yud bit and sivkot and kuf yud beis is choshesh shel Rabbi Yerucham, so therefore it made it. Now we should also point out that the tashbeit is called by the pischei tshuva right at the beginning of hilchos mikvaos, that we try to be choshesh for all the chumras and mikvaos, not as a matter of that we're so machmer and hilchos mikvaos in general, but just because since a mikvah is usually not something that everyone has in their own home, right? If I have a mikvah in my own home, I can rely on whatever shittas I want to. But a mikvah is a communal thing, so you want to make sure that there isn't a single woman in town or any person in town that's going to say, I'm not going to the mikvah because you're not choshesh for this day or that day or whatever. So you want the mikvah to be yotzeh l'kuli alma. That's what the Tashbeit says. I guess in Reb Dovid Miller's mikvahos, he was allowed to come up with his coolest because you have a mikvah in your own living room. Not such a big deal. Fine. So the principle of Hashaka is a relatively straightforward principle, and that should enable a mikvah to work pretty simply, that you just have two holes in the ground, one hole full of meha'ir, the other hole, you wait until the rain falls, it fills up, and then you connect them ayadei Hashaka, and everything is good to go. There's a few problems with the Hashaka issue. The basic problem with Hashaka is human error. That maybe the Meha'ir never rose to the level of the Hashaka hole. If it never rose to the level of the Hashaka hole, so then when you go into the mikvah, you're going into your bathtub, and you're still Temeyim in HaTorah. That's a very serious problem. There are other problems of... Again, the basic issue is human error. There's another issue in terms of cleanliness. Now, if I have two things of water, the two might interchange, they might go back and forth, and that could create a problem. Fine. Now, there's another eitzah, though, to build mikvaos, and that is ayudei zariah. Zariah is the one that's mentioned in Mishnayis. Now, Hashak is not mentioned in Mishnayis. Zariah is. Zariah basically is, the Mishnah speaks about, I have a higher mikvah and a lower mikvah. So what I do is, my higher mikvah is kosher water. I could be mamale bakate. If I fill up barrels, I pour it into the higher mikvah, and then it goes down, and I fill up the lower mikvah with the water. No? That is Zariah. Zariah also works to be machshir mikvah. Not a problem whatsoever. The problem with Zariah, though, is that there's a day of the Ravid in the Balei HaNefesh that the Ravid is worried for about Nasan Sa'ah and Natal Sa'ah. In other words, the first time I put the water into this higher kosher mikvah, so I have 40 Sa'ah of kosher water, and then I pour my pasul water, my meha'ir, in, and okay, but still, rove of the water for sure that comes out is going to be kosher water, so I'm good to go, right? But Eventually, I'm going to have a problem called Nasan Savanatosa. In other words, if I would be able to trace the water, so then eventually I might have a problem that the majority of my water is not the original kosher water, but now the majority of my water is my pasul meha'ir. So the Ravid is nervous about Nasan Savanatosa. Rov Rishonim obviously don't hold like the Ravid. The Rambam, actually, interestingly, might hold like the Ravid, but Rav Rishon don't hold like the Ravid. And therefore, the Chazon Ish writes that you should build mikvaos just with Zariah. And that was, the Chazon Ish had a famous mikvah mission, no? He tried to build mikvaos all around Eretz Yisrael, in all the kibbutzim, everywhere to encourage people to keep Taras HaMishpacha. Those mikvaos were built just with Zariah, not with any Hashaka. The story is that he said, listen, you want to do Hashaka, why? Because you're worried about the rivet of Nosan Sa'ah and Natal Sa'ah. Even with Hashaka, there still is going to be a problem, no? Because once I hold of the Rabbeinu Yerucham that Hashaka should be Hashaka Tmidis, so that means that the water is constantly going back and forth through that hole. So it could be, eventually, that the water in my original bar is no longer the 40 Sa'ah of kosher water that I need. So he says, what? You want to use Hashaka because you're nervous about the Ravid, you still have a Ravid problem in a mikveh with Hashaka. So then there were various tests that were done by people to try to figure out maybe the water doesn't shift over, maybe it does, etc. Many confusing issues. Well, Maisa, what is done in mikvehos today is that we do both Hashaka and Zariah. Right, with the exception of those mikvahs and Eretz Yisrael, both according to the Chazon Ish, almost every new mikvah that's built today has both Hashaka and Zariah. Because they want to accommodate the Zariah people, and they want to accommodate the Hashaka people. Not a problem. Now, there were other Eitzes that were done, though, to make sure that the Chazon Ish's taina, that the water keeps on shifting, will be satisfied. Yeah.
The Chazon Ish, what might make mikvahs specifically of Zariah?
Chazon Ish said, make mikvahs only with Zariah because you don't pass him like the Ravid. If you would pass him like the Ravid, Hashaka wouldn't help either. Lamaisa today, we do both Hashakas and Zariahs in our mikvahs. And there are pictures in the, what it looks like. There are pictures about where you have the bar Hashaka, where you have the bar Zariah. That's not a problem. Other eitzes that are done, though, is to make sure that the water won't shift. That if you do the Hashaka not side to side, do the Hashaka top to bottom, maybe that will solve the problem. This is done very often by having a split-level bar. That you have like a piece of plexiglass inside the bar, and instead of having 40 soft water, I have 80 soft water, 40 under the plexiglass, 40 above the plexiglass. The force of gravity will mean that it's less likely that the water will shift top to bottom than it would side to side. So therefore, we do Hashaka. We have a split level Hashaka, and that solves the problem. Lubavitchers have a very similar Eitzah that they dig a bar Tachton. In other words, that they go into the mikvah, and underneath the mikveh where they're being tovel, they have the real water. And there's a little hole at the bottom. And it's the same type of idea, that al yidei the gravity, the water is less likely to move from place to place. There are a few problems with these eitzes. First of all, it's unclear in postgame exactly how big that hole has to be. There was a discussion that some of the postgame had, I think the Chelkas Yaakov, right, Rav Breish, who was a mechutin of the Minchas Yitzchak, right, that's the way the whole story goes. So the Rav Breish had this idea that maybe you don't need a hole of Shvoferes Hanur when it is a hole that is top to bottom. You only need Shvoferes Hanur when side to side. And then Rav Moshe Sternbach wrote to him, he said, no, that you're basing yourself on the Perish HaRosh and Meseches Mikvaos, but Lamaisa, that's incorrect. It's an incorrect read, etc. And you always need a hole the size of Shofar's Handod. So that's one issue that comes up. Another issue that comes up is that the Divrei Chaim feels that Hashaka always has to be side to side. Hashaka can never be top to bottom. Since the Gemara in Gittin has a principle, the Katafris Eino Chibor, that when I have two men Tahara and there's one thing on top, one thing on bottom, so it's not considered a Chibor for two men Tahara, so also it's not considered Chibor for Mikvos. That's what the Divrei Chaim said. In the Sefer Mikvei Mayim, he contends that the only time it's a problem of Katafris is when you have like a pipe that connects an item on top with an item on bottom. But if the item on top is mamish touching the item on bottom, that's not considered katafras, and that would not be a problem. But lemaisa, there are certain people who are nervous about even the split-level hashakas for that reason. There's also Rabbi Simon once gave a shiur about maybe hushak or mushak, that maybe hashaka only works in direct proximity, maybe if I do hashaka to something that itself had hashaka, maybe that doesn't help. That's also, that's already advanced lumdis. But the fact is, our mikvaos today are built generally with many, many chumras. We have a zriya and a hashaka. We also split the level so that we have a hashaka tachton, and the feeling is that that will prevent the water from going back and forth. Another thing that we do when we build mikvahs today is we use the principle of hamshacha. Hamshacha is described in the Gemara in Temura, where the Gemara says that there's a machlokas whether you can be metahir with reviya and hamshacha or not. Reviya and hamshacha basically means that you have most of the water being regular kosher water, and the rest of the water is ayidei hamshacha. Hamshacha means instead of pouring the mayim she'uvim indirectly, if I pour the mayim she'uvim on the ground, and then it flows into the mikvah, that's called hamshacha. Many Rishonim hold that reviya and hamshacha, if most of it is going to be kosher water and a little bit came in ayidei hamshacha, that's at worst a psul midrabanan. So we use hamshacha in our mikvaos. Whenever any water goes anywhere, it goes ayidei hamshacha, which solves some problems. There's a machlokes harishonim about how big, how long the hamshacha has to be. Does the hamshacha have to be gimel tefachim, or is hamshacha kol shehu enough? Right? So we generally have a chiddush that we use from Reb Velv or Rabbi Sablonsky, like a funny story about this, that the idea is that you only need one tefach of karka that's ro'i levloa, but you need hamshach of a total of gimel tefachim. The idea of ro'i levloa also is a machlokas harishonim. When I do hamshacha, does it have to go over the type of ground that absorbs? Does it have to go over dirt? Or is it enough to just be poured over any sort of ground? That's also machlekes harishonim. Lemaisa, Reb Velvo explained that these two principles are working based on the same lumdis, that ro'i levloa means it becomes like a chelak of the ground, but then you don't need gimel tefachim. Right? So effectively, according to Reb Velvo, you only need one tefach of karka, of real karka, that's ro'i levloa, and the hamshach of a total of gimel tefachim, and that would solve the entire problem. That is generally what's done. We don't want to have the hamshach go over dirt entirely, because dirt is dirty. Dirt is dirty, and we don't want dirty things going into our mikvah. That's a general issue that we have. It happens that today the mikvah builders say that you can have a type of concrete that is very porous, that won't make the water dirty, but will still be considered kaka roi levloa. So that is the story of hamshacha. In terms of she'uvim, there's also the discussion about pipes, whether an inadvertent hole that, or inadvertent, I wouldn't say, dent that appears in the pipe, is that a problem of is that considered mayim she'uvim? Is it only considered she'uvim if I have kavana? Even if I don't have kavana, any time water ends up in a keli, that makes it she'uvim. That's a machlokas harishonim. Lamaisa would probably make on this shaila, but since in mikvos you try to be machmir for everything, so Rabbi Sablonsky had the story about how he went up to the roof, and the mikvah constructor man pointed out that, like, the area on the top of the screw where you screw it in was potentially a keli, no? Because water could be absorbed there. So they had to use silly putty to cover those things up. And that is all inadvertent she'iva. In pipes. They used to use wooden pipes in mikvahs. Wooden pipes always had these issues. Then they moved over to metal pipes. Metal pipes are less likely to have these issues, but metal pipes have a different issue, no? The Gemara in Zvachim says that a mikvah can't be havayos or yedavar mekabel tuma, no? The way I establish a mikvah can't be through something that is susceptible to tuma. Metal is susceptible to tuma. So, how do I get around that problem? So, Chassam Sofer writes in Tshuvas, it's quoted in the Pesachei Tshuva over here in Hilchos Mikvah, so Chassam Sofer says that once the pipes are attached to the ground, they're not mekabel tuma. So that was always a standard practice, that they used metal pipes in mikvaos, and they assume that's not mekabel tuma. But in recent years, we got better, because now we can use plastic. And plastic has all the milas. Plastic is both not makabel tumah, and plastic also doesn't, unlike wood, which gets these little dents in, right? Dents and holes in it, plastic does not. So that is the story of She'uven. Let's just talk about a few more concepts in mikvaos, and then we'll take questions on mikvaos. We're almost done with it. There is another psul in mikvaos, which is probably a psul d'oraisa. Unlike she'uvin, where there's machlekes harishonim, if it's d'oraisa, the psul of zochalin, the pashtus is d'oraisa. There might be a Mordechai who disagrees, but kemat, everyone in Judaism assumes that mikvah, by definition, means that the water is kavu v'kaimi, that the water is stagnant. If the water is moving, zochlin, so that is going to be a problem. Pashtus is a problem d'oraisa. There might be machlokas in terms of the shear. Let's say I have a teeny crack in the mikvah. Does that create zochlin? So on this field trip that we took in the Kol HaOyon, so Rabbi Rosenzweig told the story. It's like the only Hasidisha story I ever heard Rabbi Rosenzweig say, but it wasn't really a Hasidisha story, it was a Brisker Hasidisha story. Apparently Rabbi Rosenzweig quoted somebody who met the Brisker Rav years before, and they had shown the Brisker Rav a mikvah, and the Brisker Rav went to look at the mikvah, and the Brisker Rav noticed a little crack in that mikvah. And from years after, whenever this fellow would see the Brisker Rav, he'd start to titter, he'd start to shake, because he found the crack in the mikvah. We are generally machmir. Any crack in a mikvah creates a psul of zochalin, right? Because the water is going to flow out. The question is, though, what about if the crack is high up on the wall of the mikvah, which is called zechilo lamayla mimem? So even if the crack flows out, even if the water flows out, I'll still have our batim sa'a. That's a machlokas harishonim. That's two opinions in Shulchan Aruch about zechila lamayla mimem. Right? Then there is that relates to the lumdus of zechila. If the pshat in zechila is that mikvah by definition is only metaher when it's stagnant water, so any flow passes the entire mikvah. But if the pshat in zechila is the way the Vilna Gaon says it, zechila is a psul somehow that it lacks shear, because it can only be metzdarif things when they are stagnant. But when it's moving, I can't be mitzdarif it, by definition. So if it lacks shear, then zechila ma'ala mimem would be okay. The Gra, interestingly, I don't think Rabbi Sabolovsky mentioned it, the Gra seems to be machmir on what's called zechila she'ena nikeres also, no? If I have a tiny crack in the mikvah, and you don't notice that the water level is going down, does that pass on the mikvah? So generally in Shulchan Aruch it sounds like it's not a problem. The grass seems like he's machmer. Zechila she'ena nikeres also. The way they used to measure it is that they would take a marker and you'd make a line where the water level is, and you go back, right? And you go back like 2 weeks later and you see it went down a little bit more than would have gone down just by evaporation. That's like the variable over here. So then you know that there's an issue of zechila. Because zechila is a problem in HaTorah, that's why there's a story of Rabbi Sabolovsky had about some woman calling from Honolulu, and she went to the mikvah in the waterfall. That's very bad. That's a psul d'oraisa. No, that doesn't work. Zechila, right, is only a psul, though, in a mikvah. In a mayan, it's not a problem. What about rivers? Are rivers considered a mikvah or a mayan? So it's a discussion in the Gemara Nedarim, and Daf Mem, very long run in the Dorim about rivers. Lamaisa, the Rabbeinu Tam was Mekon being Tovel in rivers. The other Rishonim were Machmer being Tovel in rivers, depending how you read the Gemara there and the Gemara in Bechoros. The Trumas Hadeshim points out that this used to be a Shidduch question that people ask, no? Whether your mother went to a regular mikvah or did she go into a river? That was one of the things. It wasn't like white tablecloths. It was like a different issue that people wanted to know in Shidduchim to find out the type of family that you are. Lamaisa, we generally do not go to mikveh in rivers against the Rabbeinu Tam. A lake, right? If you get a shaila on a lake, I've had these shailas. People call me up. They say, oh, we're on vacation and we want to go tovel in Lake Champlain. Okay, well, Lake Champlain is massive, first of all. Where in Lake Champlain are you? And then you have to call somebody who really knows the area. Rabbi Simon has a guy. Rabbi Simon has a Hasidish fellow, Chaim Zalman Klein, who knows every lake everywhere, and he'll tell you exactly, oh, which resort is it? This place, okay, that's okay, that's not okay. You have to really No, because if a lake has an outlet, then it's zoichlin. If a lake doesn't have an outlet, right, if it has an outlet, it's like a river. If it doesn't have an outlet, so then it could be that you could be tovel in the lake, assuming it's a natural lake, not a man-made lake, etc. You really have to know what you're doing. The extended parts of lakes could be problems. That area is considered man-made, and sometimes they are pour the water indirectly. You really have to know the story. Oceans is a machlokas hatanoim. Lemaisa, we pass him Ikar Din that oceans are okay, but there might be a problem of chatzitza in oceans because A, you might be uncomfortable to go into the mikvah undressed, like on a beach or something. Maybe people will see you, so you might be tovel too quickly. B, maybe some sand will get caught in your feet, and that will be a problem. We'll take questions in 2 minutes. I just want to finish up very quickly. One of the big issues that comes up with Zechila is the question of a filter. Mikvos today have filters because you want to keep it clean. If you go into the mikvah when the filter is on, is that a problem of Zochlin or not? The Rivash writes, that's only Zochlin if the water flows out. But if the water flows around and around and around, you happen to go into some whirlpool somewhere, that's not Zochlin. Okay, that would be a good Eitzah by a filter. The only thing is that the way the Ramah quotes the Rivash, the Ramah says, only if a little bit of water. That means if there's a lot of water that flows around and around and around, that would be a problem. Lameisa, we generally tell people if they went to the mikveh with the filter on, and mikvahs have all these precautions not to go in when the filter's on, but we tell people generally to be tovel again. There is a question about how you build a mikveh in a place where it doesn't rain. Usually we take ice. You have to make sure that it doesn't become she'uven. What do you mean? Ice can't become she'uven? Well, first of all, there's one day in Mishnah the ice does become she'uven. There's a bahamar. Okay, fine. But that bahamar is not really accepted. Right? So, but it can become she'uven as it begins to melt. Ice becomes water when it melts, no? So as it begins to melt, so it could be that some of the ice becomes water and now is trapped on the bottom of a keli. So what they used to do is they had specially made kalim that had holes in the bottom, so it wouldn't make she'uvim. Right? Today they use freezer trucks. No, it's much easier. You make sure it doesn't melt now, because there's a freezer in the truck and everything is good to go. There's a discussion about man-made ice. Whether most poskim do not assume that man-made ice works. It has to be that you clop off natural chunks of ice and then you build a mikvah. So I think this is the basic issues in mikvahs. Let's take a few questions on Rabbi Sabolovsky's shir, then we'll move on to Rabbi Simon's mezuzah shirim. You had a question before? I guess I answered it, or you forgot it. Many possibilities. Yeah.
Let's say the person who was below the crack.
Right, so that's the question. If there's a crack on Malam Mimem, it's two opinions in Shulchan Aruch whether it's possible or not. If it's possible, that means all the water is possible. So even if I'm Toivel, the Shaila about Zechila Lamala Mimem, no? If any of you ever go to the Breuer's Mikvah, like Erev Yom Kippur, so they like to run the filter every couple of hours to keep it clean, but the filter only filters the water at the top. Right, so there's 40 so of water at the bottom that's not being filtered. So, are you allowed to go in when the filter is on only lamala mimem? This is a lamda sheshav zechila lamayla mimem. I happen to have been make on this. This Erev Yom Kippur Rabbi Harari was not. I was in a bigger rush than he was. It's mikveh Erev Yom Kippur is like, yeah, whatever. Reb Sadia Gaon holds it's a real chiyuv of tefillah Erev Yom Kippur. No, lefnei Hashem tetaru. The Rosh was Reb Sadia. Most Rishonim don't take the Reb Sadia very seriously. Reb Sadia would feel that you'd make a bracha when you go to the mikveh Erev Yom Kippur. No, we don't do that. Okay. Any other questions on mikvahs? Fine. Mezuzah. On the mikvahs, you have to know one pasuk in the Torah. The Torah says, Mayin bar mikveh mam yetohar, that's it. Mezuzah also, you have to know one pasuk. Luchsavtam a mezuzah besecha visharecha. Luchsavtam, we're not going to discuss, that's like for the sofrim, that's already advanced for us. What does besecha mean? What does besharecha mean? So bias in Tanakh Hebrew does not mean a house. There was a practice to put only one mezuzah on the house. That practice was not really looked kindly upon by the Rishonim. Beisecha means a room. Any room that is Dalet Amos al Dalet Amos is considered a bias. Dal amos 7 3/4 feet by 7 3/4 feet. That is considered a bias in halacha. If a room is smaller than that, so l'chora, that's not a bias. And then there would be no chiyuv of a mezuzah on such a room. However, and just to, there is a discussion, though, the Chamudei Daniel is called by the Pischei Tshuva, that if I have a smaller room, and there's also a Rashash and Sukkah and Daf Gimel who says something along these lines, if I have a smaller room, but it's chazi l'tashmishei, it's used, even though it's less than dalal al dalal, there still is a chiyuv mezuzah on that smaller room. That would mean, according to Chamudei Daniel, I have a closet, less than dalal al dalal, I put my mezuzah going into the closet. Yeah? Rabbi Kiva Eger there, however, quotes that he thinks that maybe the kuchla, whatever he talks about, is nidon, like it's outside of the house. And the standard explanation of the Rabbi Kiva Eger would be when they have a closet, I should put my mezuzah going from the closet into the house. Now, I should also point out that when I talk about closet, the Minchas Yitzchak notes in the Tshuva, I'm only talking about a walk-in closet. A closet that I only put my hand in, there's no chiyuv whatsoever. Because the Torah says beisecha, which means bi'oscha, the way I go in. If I never go in, obviously there's no chiyuv whatsoever. If I have a walk-in closet, less than dalet al dalet, so then, according to the Chamudei Daniel L'chorek, the mezuzah should go into the closet. The pashtus in Rabbi Kiva Eger is, or the standard explanation of Rabbi Kiva Eger is that the mezuzah should go on the way out of the closet. Now, Rav Shechter paskins like this Rabbi Kiva Eger straight up, or like the conventional understanding of Rabbi Kiva Eger. So if you go into homes of Talmidim of Rav Shechter, they'll have mezuzahs on their closets going out of the closet into the house. Rabbi Simon in the Shir really does not like this, no? Rabbi Simon feels that this conventional understanding of Rabbi Kiva Eger is against all of Hilchos Mezuzah. He gets like very animated sometimes, and right, he stands up and he shows, because the Yesod of Mezuzah, Rabbi Simon says, is that there is no backtracking, no? How come every room does not get two mezuzahs? One in, one out. Answer: because I only go the initial way I go in. So my closet, right? I go into the closet. I'm going to say that the closet's like the outside of the house, and you put the mezuzah going from the closet into the house. Right? That, l'chora, is a violation of the principle of backtracking. Therefore, Rabbi Simon feels that this is a mistaken understanding of the Rabbi Kiva Eger. Rather, what Rabbi Kiva Eger really was referring to is a door that is only used in one way. It's like an emergency exit. No? The back of the Gluck Beis Medrash. That door is never used to go in. And we tried for a long time to get them to open that door, like on Shabbos. Right? It would made it easier for the for women. It made it easier for many people, right? To have that door in the, you know what I'm talking about? So that door, Lamaisa, is treated like an exit. Well, if something's an exit only, is there a chi of mezuzah? So it could be that's what Rabbi Kiva Eger is saying, that something's an exit only, you have the chi of mezuzah going out. Maybe that's what he meant. Others might say that if something's an exit only, you have Shechter holds this way, you have the chi of mezuzah going in. Still others might say, Rabbi Simon quoted from Rav Abadi, that fundamentally you're potter. Me'ikar din, Rabbi Simon holds about the closet question, that there is no chiyuv of mezuzah on these closets. It's a chumrah to put a mezuzah up. If you want to put one up, do the Chamudei Daniel way, not the conventional Rabbi Kiva Eger way, because Rabbi Simon thinks that the conventional understanding of Rabbi Kiva Eger might not be precise, might not be correct. So that's the first issue of bias. Bias has to be dalet al dalet. There's a machlokes harishonim, presumably, Rambam and Rush. When I say dalet al dalet, does that have to be 4 by 4? What about if it's 8 by 2? According to the advanced mathematics I learned in Yeshiva College, 8 by 2 multiplies out to be the same as 4 by 4. Right? Is that good enough? So it's generally understood this is a machlokes Rambam and Rush. The Taz, however, in Hilchos Sukkah, points out that he thinks that there's no machlokes Rambam and Rush, that everybody would say that what? That you have to have 4 by 4. Everyone would say that you need 2 dimensions. So if I have a room that's very narrow, so it's not going to be chayiv and mezuzah according to that. Some of the kitchens in the Heights and some of the other rooms in the Heights even might be a total of, let's say, 16 square amos. But you don't have it in two dimensions. It won't be 4x4. The Shach would say it's Machlokas Rambam and Rush. The Taz would say that there ain't no Machlokas. So that's another issue that comes up in terms of the definition of Bayis. It has to be Dalet al Dalet. Another issue that comes up about the definition of Bayis is that it has to be, like the Gemara, beginning of Pesachim says, that Mezuzah is Chovas Hador, which means it has to be that you live there, no? Have to be that I live there. Rashi writes there that that's the yisod of Shmira, no? Now, mezuzah is supposed to protect you. I just was speaking to someone in my shul the other night. They've been having some difficulty, whatever, so he asked me a shayla. He's like, I just took all the mezuzahs in my apartment down to buy new ones, and I'm going to make a new bracha. So what would you say? We didn't get to this din yet, but the answer is, yeah, you probably have to make new brachas, no? One new bracha on the room that's mamish chayiv and mezuzah. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Because if I take the mezuzah down and I'm going to put the same thing back up in a very short time, then we assume you don't get a bracha. But if you exchange it for a different mezuzah, then l'chor, you need a bracha. Why do people take the mezuzahs down and replace them? Because they're worried about something in the shmirah. Like, things aren't going well in life, no? The Mets are having a bad season. Actually, they're not. But I need something. I need something to protect me. So, mezuzah protects me. Okay, so that's why people sometimes exchange their mezuzahs based on that Rashi and Pesachim, that it's a din of Shmira. That's also why the last din in Hilchos Mezuzahs, that when I leave my apartment, I'm not supposed to take my mezuzah with me, no? Ushaya Yukas Shar, the Gemara says in Bava Metzia, that the Shadim come. The mezuzah will protect the bias from the Shadim coming. So therefore, when I move out of an apartment, I should not take my mezuzah with me. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. I leave the mezuzah. I'm allowed to sell the mezuzah to the next tenant, but I should leave it with me. That's a strict halacha. L'maisa today, we take the mezuzahs with us, no? In most cases. Rav Shechter passes to take the mezuzahs with you because l'maisa, they're going to paint the apartment after you move out. In almost all cases, they'll paint the apartment. If they're painting the apartment, so then there's going to be some time that the mezuzah is there, and only goyim are coming in and out, and the mezuzah will be mutar b'bizayon, no? They won't treat the mezuzah with the proper respect. And if they're not going to treat the mezuzah with the proper respect, so then you should take the mezuzah with you when you move out. Rabbi Simon also mentioned that Rav Abadi holds that you can take the mezuzah with you bisman hazeh when you move out. I'm not exactly sure of what the cheshbin is, if Rabbi Abadi is saying the same cheshbin as Rav Shechter says, but in most cases we do take the mezuzah with us when we move out because of this cheshbin of painting. So again, so mezuzah is chovas hadar. Mezuzah is supposed to be shmira. Now, chovas hadar means it has to be a place where you live. What do you mean a place where I live? So the poskim have a discussion about a base medrash. Is a base medrash chayiv in mezuzah? Is a base kinesis chayiv in mezuzah? What does it say in Shulchan Aruch? So base kinesis is not chayiv in mezuzah, no? Unless you have poor people who happen to live in the base kinesis, and it's chayiv in mezuzah. Base medrash is considered a little more of dira than the base kinesis, because in the base medrash, people are there miboker ad erev. Base kinesis, people are only there during davening time. Now again, Rabbi Simon pointed out that Beis Medrash versus Beis Knesset doesn't mean that where you daven downstairs is the Beis Medrash and upstairs is the Beis Knesset. Like that's like the way they call it in the shul. Technically, those are both Batei Knesset. Beis Medrash means like yeshiva, a place that people sit miboker ad erev. So if people are there miboker ad erev, what's the reason why it's not chayiv and mezuzah? The answer is that that's considered dira shel kedusha. That's not full-fledged dira. Dira means I live there. I do whatever I do in an apartment. Dira shel kedusha is not full-fledged dira. Therefore, there might not be a chiyuv of mezuzah on the base medrash. We may ikar hadin hold there's no chiyuv of mezuzah on base medrash. The only reason we put on up is because Maharam of Rittenberg one time was sleeping shinas tzaharayim and he had a ruach miva'aso. He got scared because he didn't have a mezuzah on the base medrash. No? It sounds like, right, Maharam didn't put up a mezuzah originally. Why not? Because you don't need a mezuzah in the base medrash. And then later on, he put one up just because he was scared. It sounds like it's not a full-fledged chiyuv. This idea that to be a full-fledged shchiv has to really be a makom dira, this leads us to the discussion of like offices, no? Do you need a mezuzah in your office? It says in Shulchan Aruch, based on Gemara's, the chanuyos shebishvakim, right? Chanuyos shebishvakim, so don't have chanuyos shebishvakim, don't have a full chiv mezuzah. Why not? So the Taz basically says, because you only are there during the day, you're not there at night. Your store, when you're in the store, only during the day, not at night. So many times, according to the Taz, what should be is that if I'm there at night, also I'm a lawyer, and lawyers are there at night, or any normal office today, like people work at night also, so then maybe there is a chiyuv mezuzah. The Jerisha says that the understanding of chanuyos b'shvakim, why it's exempt from mezuzah, is because it is not a normal room. A chanuyos b'shvakim is like, you know those pop-up things? Right, it's like basically they used to have like these festivals, these yirids, a fair, and at the fair people come, they'd set up their own booth. So how do they set up a booth? Well, they'd take this foldable booth and they'd unfold it. No. So if it's not a full-fledged area, so it might not be chayiv and mezuzah. That's what the Jewish understands. So then people taina, well, our offices are full-fledged structures. Maybe they should be chayiv and mezuzah. Yeah, but you don't really live in an office, no? So the practice is that we put a mezuzah on the office without a bracha. Even the base medrash here in yeshiva, we put up the mezuzah also without a bracha. When President Joel was koveya the mezuzah on the new base medrash, she made a hatova hametiv on the building. They didn't make the bracha lakbo on mezuzah. And there's a few reasons not to make a bracha lakbo on mezuzah on the base medrash. One, it's a base medrash, and therefore it's not full-fledged dira. We have the day in Rishonim that it's dira shabbat kedusha and it's pater. Two, I could definitely tell you, being here over Pesach, there are many times that this room is not used. We'll leave it like that. Three, there are no mezuzahs. A mezuzah means a doorpost, no? If you look at the mezuzah, if you look downstairs at the base medrash, no? I think on one side there are posts, and the other side there isn't. It would be a huge tikkun to put posts up to make a chayiv mezuzah. But the din is, you need a mezuzah. Mezuzah, Rav Soloveitchik felt, means it has to be a post, which means you need something jutting out. If it's just a wall that ends, that is not considered a mezuzah, and therefore there is going to be no chiyuv. That's what the Rav said. There's a discussion we've shown them, how many mezuzahs do you need? We assume that you need a mashkof and one mezuzah, but that one mezuzah, that's why the shach paskins, one mezuzah has to be a mezuzah on the right side. The one mezuzah is a mezuzah on the left side, so then you don't have a chiyuv mezuzah. I actually have this in my apartment, my laundry room. I'm zoche, I have a mashkof. Mashkof is technically a lintel, but lintel is one of those English words. If you don't know what mashkof means, you don't know what lintel means. It's like the word Pentecost, no? Or the word phylacteries, right? Phylacteries is like the worst translation ever. No, if you have no idea what tefillin is, you don't know what phylacteries are. There's no one for whom the word phylacteries doesn't. Lintel is like the same type of word. So I have a room, my laundry room, in my apartment, where I have a lintel and I have one mezuzah. My mezuzah is on the left, not on the right. Therefore, I don't have any mezuzah hanging up there. If you want to come over, it's like my collector's item. I show people, hey, I don't have a mezuzah in this room. And in fact, I don't. Because it has to be that the mezuzah is on the right side, not on the left side. Okay, so that is the discussion of uchsaftam al mezuzos and beisecha. The word bisher orecha is the last word in that pasuk. The Gemara in Yoma, echad share batim chatseros, and even shar ha'ir is going to be chayiv in mezuzah. Zakt Rashi, it has to be when it's rov Yisrael. That means that if I'm allowed to have some goyim in the city, I'm still chayiv in mezuzah, as long as rov of it is Jews. Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, is not rov Yisrael, unfortunately, no. So, there's really no chayiv mezuzah in Yerushalayim. The fact that there is a mezuzah by Shar Yafo and by some of the other sharim that go into the Jewish quarter, that's just they hung one up, and there's really no chayiv mezuzah. That's what Rashi says. A few years ago, we wanted, when YU purchased the building that I live in 475 West 186th, so then more Jews moved into the building, and now the building is actually Rove Jews. So Rabbi Simon and I were speaking about that maybe we should have a mezuzah put up on the front door of our building. And Rabbi Simon then spoke about this with Reb David Feinstein on the Sukkot. Reb David Feinstein said that basically we don't pass them like that Rashi. Even though it's Rov Yisrael, maybe there's no chiyuv of mezuzah at all as long as there is a shutfis akum. As long as there's any one guy who lives in the building that pathers mezuzah entirely. That was what Reb David Feinstein said. I don't know. I think the pashtus is that there really should be a mezuzah on the front door of a building when it is Rov Yisrael. Rav Meir Goldrich, when you tried to put a mezuzah up, it was taken down, etc. We've gone through this. You have to fill out. There's an official mezuzah form. You could file with facilities management to have a mezuzah put up on the buildings. So again, it's always in the process. I think it would be a toeles. Fine. Now, because the word uchsad mezuzos beisecha visharecha, the Gemara dashens beisecha in terms of derech bi'ascha. Derech bi'ascha means on the right. No. Why? Because most people walk in with their right foot first. That's how we know the right. That, by the way, is no geya also for hilchos chalitza. That most people are right footed. Right? That's why we ask you to kick something, right? You are a chalit, right? That's why we ask you to kick something, which is a way of determining are you right-footed or left-footed. And there's all these rules and regulations about which side to put the mezuzah on based on where the rooms are. You can read that in the Rabbi Simon English article that's appended to his Makoril sheet. The question that comes up, though, is what about if it's no way of telling? Usually I have Heker Tzir, at least. Heker Tzir means if the door opens in or out. But let's say I have a sliding door. So which way does the mezuzah go? So they say that Rav Moshe Feinstein in these cases used to say, where did you put it up? And wherever you said you put it up, he'd say, okay, so leave it there. That's by the heck, that's by the sliding door. Could be that if there's no indication whatsoever, so it's going to be Potter. Another issue that comes up by Share Ha'ir, we've been mentioning Beisecha, Bisha'arecha, is that if it's a share that's very tall, so the Yerushalmi says, I put the mezuzah. I put the mezuzah shoulder height. I should not put the mezuzah all the way. Usually mezuzah has to be shlisha elyon, the top third. But if it's a very tall doorway, so I put the mezuzah shoulder height. That's the din. If you have kids, a room for like kids, or I remember when I was in elementary school in South Shore, Sir Yaakov Kamenetsky used to come to. Anyone else here went to South Shore Elementary School? No? Okay, so Rav Yaakov used to come, this is probably before your time, Rav Yaakov used to come and visit the school, because his son, Rav Binyamin Kamenetsky, was like the principal or whatever of the school, the Rosh Hashiva. So they had a low mezuzah over there by the kindergarten room, and Rav Yaakov said that they have to make the mezuzah higher, and that's what they did. Because Rav Yaakov said that me'ikar hadin, the mezuzah has to be shlisha elyon, and that's the proper chinuch. You want the kids to kiss the mezuzah. So Rav Yaakov recommended to have a little stool by the door, and that's how the kids would stand up and kiss the mezuzah by the kindergarten room in South Shore. Rabbi Simon said the same idea. He quoted Chuvas of the River of Ephraim, who said the same type of idea. Fine. If you have a very low doorway, like you have in some of the Washington Heights kitchen, so Rabbi Simon pointed out, it's machlokis between the Derech HaChaim Siddur and the Das Kedoshim, whether you put the mezuzah in the lower part or in the upper part, depends what's considered the Pesach. Is the Pesach only the part that I walk through, or is the Pesach the entire doorway? No? By like the Washington Heights kitchens, you have like a little shtickle wall, and it goes down, and then, right? You know what I'm talking about? So I can only walk through the very middle part, because there's a wall on the side. Do I assume that that means that the Pesach is only the very little part, and I put the mezuzah and shlisha elyon of the low part? Or did I say, no, the whole thing is considered the Pesach? There's also nogeya. In many of our buildings, we have a little decoration on the doorpost. That there's like an inner part of the doorpost and outer part of the doorpost, because there's like a molding that goes in and out. Do I put the mezuzah on the inner part of the doorpost, or do I put the mezuzah on the outer part of the doorpost? What's considered the Pesach? Is the Pesach only the part that I walk through? I don't walk through the outer part of the doorpost. I only walk through the inner part. Right? So that's the same type of question that we have in our Washington Heights apartments. Generally, the minog, I think, is that you put it on the low part. In many of these cases, it ends up being on the kitchen, so that should then depend on the machlokes Rebbe Akiva Eiger and the Chamudei Daniel, whether it's going in or out, because the kitchen in many cases is not dalet al dalet. It's not dalet al dalet because permanent fixtures are mema'it. So my counters that are attached to the wall is mema'it the shear of dalet al dalet. So therefore, my kitchen is not dalet al dalet. So Rav Shechter would say that the mezuzah goes going out of the kitchen on the little guy. Rabbi Simon would say it's putter. If you want to put it, you put it going in on the little guy. Are there any other issues that we didn't discuss in Hilchos Mezuzah? Yeah.
I was wondering with the office, if it's like a home office, is that distinguished from your house?
So a home office, we assume, is considered a chilak of the home. That's another issue, that's something that we skipped. There's a machlokes Rambam and Rush about Beis HaOtzer, whether it's chayav and mezuzah or not. The Rambam sheet that Beis HaOtzer is put from mezuzah does not make it to Shulchan Aruch. The Rush holds Beis HaOtzer is chayav and mezuzah that makes it in Shulchan Aruch. However, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rabbi Abari both say that Beis HaOtzer is only chayav and mezuzah when it's attached to the house. If I have, let's say, a storage area, like many people who live in apartments for their entire life don't have enough space in their apartment for everything, so they buy spaces in these storage things. Do you have to put a mezuzah in your storage area? It's Beis HaOtzer, I'm storing my stuff. Or before I move into my apartment, no? And so I take a lease and I'm going to move into the apartment a few weeks from now. So I put my furniture in before I move in. It's a Beis HaOtzer. I have a chiyuv mezuzah when I start storing the stuff. So both Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rabbi Abadi say that the din of storage is only that's nitpal labayis. It becomes a chiluk of the house, right? So if I'm living there, then I'm chayiv in Beis HaOtzer. But if I just have storage on its own, I'm not chayiv. Right? So similarly also, if I put my furniture in an apartment before I live there, so there might not be any chiyuv even out space or altar in that situation. That's what should arise, yeah.
With the door, you were saying if it's a sliding door, it might be putter?
Because it's not clear which way it goes. If does it go in or out? It goes sideways.
Right, but let's say there was no door.
If there's no door, so you're saying it's no worse than the regular doorway?
And
okay.
Right? And then the other question is, how do we distinguish between like one bias and another bias? Is it that there's a lintel and a...
The definition of bias is dalet al dalet.
But let's say there's like a... How do you...
In other words, so if I have two rooms, sometimes like in the apartments in the Heights, you have like a living room. My part we broke through. So I have two different living rooms right next to each other. And I have like a big beam in between. Do I need a mezuzah between those two rooms? L'chore not. Rav Shechter always says that there's no chelok hishtamshus and there's no, it's the same room. If there is a chelok hishtamshus, if one room's a living room, one room's a dining room, then you would need. But if there's no, you use the same room, it's just pillars in middle for decorative purposes, it could be there's no chiyuv of mezuzah. That's the question in first hall, no? And first of all, they have these doorways that just divide up the hallway. You know what I'm talking about? So there's no chilak hishtamshas over there. The pashtus is, it should not be a chiyuv mezuzah. They say that the Rav went through first hall and decided where they put mezuzahs. So I'm not exactly sure what's going on there.
So if the one room was a dining room and the other was living room, then you might...
If I have a lintel and they have a door post on the right side, then I have a chiyuv mezuzah. Yeah. Yeah.
What do we say about the 8x2 room? What was it then?
So the pashtus is the machlokas Rambam and Rush. The Taz says there's no machlokas. We generally assume that there's no chiyuv unless it's 4x4. Yeah.
8x2, we assume it's not a mezuzah.
It doesn't need a mezuzah. If you want to put one up, you can. Yeah. There would be an Isser Baal Tosef if you have two mezuzahs on the same way in the doorpost, no? They have this in my shul. I just called the executive director to get him to take it down. Someone donated a mezuzah in the shul, so they hung the mezuzah up and they didn't take the old mezuzah down. So now I have two mezuzahs on one doorpost. So that's a real Isser of Baal Tosef. If I have one mezuzah going in, one mezuzah going out, that might not be Baal Tosef. That might just be, it looks silly. So you don't do that. But they say that Reb Chaim Moser did it. Reb Simon mentioned this year that Reb Chaim Moser had one room in his house at a suffix, so he had two mezuzahs. But generally, we don't do that. But two on one, that would be Baal Tosef, yeah. Okay. So that is the issue with mezuzah. Now let's talk for a few minutes about homosexuality, Dr. Lamb's shiur. This was actually 4 shiurim, not 2. Right? Both Rabbi Simon and Rabbi Savolsky gave 2 shiurim. So if you think I'm like draining too much, realize that we've already done 4 weeks of the semester. Okay. Dr. Lamb spoke about homosexuality. I never thought I'd have to have homosexuality as part of a contemporary halacha curriculum. But today I could tell you, again, I haven't been in the business of rabbonos for that long. I've been a rabbi now for almost 3 years. And I was surprised on my interview when they asked me about what I would do with the homosexuals in shul. I was surprised on a certain level because as a guy coming from yeshiva, I didn't know anyone who was gay. There was one person I knew, a friend of my wife from Princeton. But like that's a different world. Like my world, I felt like this is inconceivable that I'd have to deal with this issue. But I deal with it. I deal with it on a pretty regular basis. Again, I don't know the exact numbers. I don't know the real numbers, but there are people who say that there's around 30 gays and lesbians in my shul. I don't know if it's true or not, but you know, many of you know my shul. It's like a stone's throw away. It's a real issue. It's a real issue to figure out how to deal with. For rabbonim of our generation, the rabbonim 10 years ago, 15 years ago, had to spend a lot of time focusing on the women's issues, for lack of a better term. I don't like the term women's issues because they're not issues only for women. These are issues for all people in the Orthodox community. But for lack of a better term, we'll call them the women's issues. Rabbonim, a few years ago, that was the issue that could really bury a rov. Today, the women's issues are still there. But for a large segment of the community, the issue that's more troubling, the issue that could really come up and you have to be prepared for, is the issue of how to deal with homosexuality. Philosophically, it's very troubling. How could HaKadosh Baruch Hu create people who don't have any permitted outlet and never will? That's a troubling issue. Practically, how you deal with people in your shul who are homosexuals, in terms of giving them aliyahs, in terms of giving them other honors, is a real issue. It's a real issue. You know, we all, most of us, probably 98% of us, were in the yeshiva not so long ago when the issue came to the fore in a very, very public way that made many people in yeshiva on both sides of the issue very uncomfortable. I don't think anyone who was here in yeshiva at that time had Yishuv Hadas and was able to learn well for those couple of days. I'm just begging you to not focus as much on the details of Rabbi Lamb's shiur, which is important in its own right, but to focus on the larger issue. How are you going to deal with these issues when you, and it's not that long from now, enter the field? Use the time now in yeshiva to speak to your rebbeim, to speak to mentors of yours, people who might not be your rebbeim but are out in the field already, to find out how they deal with these issues, to mull it over in your own minds, to try to come up with a mahalach so that you're not blindsided. I really was blindsided, and I thought through many issues. I had long treatises that I could give about the women's issue, etc. I was blindsided by this issue. I didn't expect it to come up. It did come up. It was very painful. I could tell you that I had many conversations with Talmidei Chachamim before and after. I spoke to Reb David Cohen, I spoke to Reb Aaron Lichtenstein at length about this. It was a very valuable conversation for me. I spoke to Reb Schechter, of course, about the question of giving people aliyahs. And they all said, Pe'echad, Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, Reb Schechter, Reb David Cohen, They had different nuskos. Rav David Cohen said, how do you know they're doing any aveir? If someone says that they're gay, maybe that's just their identity. That's an important piece of the equation. Identity doesn't mean action. They all said that if someone is homosexual, there's no reason to deny them aliyahs and other synagogue honors, but if someone is out to set an agenda for the shul, zeh mashu acheret legamrei. I had someone in my shul who spoke to me in all seriousness about hanging a rainbow flag from the front of the shul. He no longer davens in the shul. It was painful for everybody. It still is painful. He's a really good guy. But if someone is trying to set an agenda for the shul that is out loud and proud, that if it would be about any aveira, if someone would want to be out loud and proud about eating, about drinking New York City water with copepods, I'd also try to make them uncomfortable in the shul. The idea is that we have to be tolerant and respectful, and you know, it's an unbelievable nesayon, and give honors in 99% of the cases. But if you confront somebody who is of a different, who's trying to set a tone and an agenda, so then you have to treat them in a different sort of way, and that's very difficult. The most valuable part of Rabbi Lamb's shiur was the question and answer, the scenarios that he and Rabbi Drach went through. They spoke about aliyahs and shul. They largely said what we mentioned in this brief introduction. They said that there's no reason to deny admission to the child of gays in school, or if you have someone in school who is gay, that doesn't mean the person doesn't deserve a Torah education. That was their approach. But when it came to an issue of like a musmach of yeshiva who is performing gay weddings, and again, whatever the apologetics is, that it wasn't kedushin, it was some sort of sanctification ceremony or whatever, but that's something for which you can have no tolerance for. Again, I think this is all very consistent with the approach that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein told me. Do you wish people mazel tov when they adopt, if a gay couple adopts? That's a really tough one. You know, what Dr. Lamb said is that, you know, you have to use a lot of seichel. These are very hard issues. Sometimes you can't give a simple answer. From a purely halachic perspective, because in our society, homosexuality is certainly, it might not be more prevalent than it was a few years ago, but it is certainly more public than it was. That can, the Beis Yosef and in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Chof Daled of Eben HaEzer, he paskins that Yesh Li Zahir from Yichud with the Zahar, when there is when homosexuality is prevalent or rampant in the society. The Bach disagrees, because the Bach in his society didn't have homosexuality being rampant. But if it is, so then certainly the Yesh Li Zahir. It's a real issue. Obviously, male homosexuality is more serious than female homosexuality. Male homosexuality is arayos. Female homosexuality, there's a discussion. Hey, if you look in Eben Ezer Simen Chaf, there's a discussion in the Levush and the other Achronim. The Otzar Poskim is wonderful. He has all the sources. It's a Dereis and it's a Derabonon. But even if it's an Issa Dereis, it's not Arayis. Male homosexuality is Arayis. Now, FYI, if someone identifies as being gay, that probably does not mean that they are engaged in what would be considered arayus from the halachic perspective. It's kedai to get Chaim Rappaport's book on homosexuality. Everything that Dr. Lamb said is wonderful. Chaim Rappaport is the more recent work on homosexuality in Halacha. He points out extensively that the data shows that most male homosexuals are doing actions which might be an issa d'oraisa. If female homosexuality is an issa d'oraisa, like many assume, so male homosexuality, even without penetration, is also d'oraisa, but it's not arayis. In most cases, people do not engage in what's actually called arayis, or so Chaim Rappaport claims. The big issue that comes up now, and it's being dealt with in the press, and again, because our generation, everything is very public, so people don't just answer shilas. People have to come up with proclamations. You have to have 500 people sign one document, 500 people sign a different document. And if you take both documents together, they're both saying what's true, but each document is not saying what the other is saying, so you're only getting half of the picture. V'hameven yavin. But in our society, because everything is very public, this issue becomes even harder to deal with. The big issue that comes up now is there's an organization called JONA, and there are questions on JONA because of some of the people who run the organization. And there are questions on JONA because it's not clear in the medical literature if reparative therapy helps or doesn't help. It's certainly not clear. Chaim Rappaport in his book contends that my religion doesn't force me to believe in the failed therapy. That's a valid approach. Dr. Lamb mentioned in the class that JONA is largely discredited. In his published material, which is from 2002, he was much more positive about JONA. He handed out the published material. Again, it's kedai to read, but things change. The information is changing. The basic issue that the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Lamb, was dealing with in his article is to try to construct an overall theory of how to deal with homosexuals. And he distinguished between different types of homosexuals. There are people who are transitory homosexuals, who occasionally will try homosexuality for lack of other opportunity. There are people who ideologically want to benefit everything that is available in the smorgasbord of life. There are people who are attracted to both men and women. For all of these types, you have no sympathy. But if you have someone who Dr. Lamb calls a genuine homosexual, which means that that person has no attraction to people of the opposite sex, in that situation, Dr. Lamb developed the approach that the person is an onus. Onus in the sense that we view that he is compulsed into his action. That doesn't exonerate him in the sense of saying what he's doing is not an aveira. It is an aveira. It's a maisa aveira. But there's no onesh on an ones. That's Dr. Lamb's basic article. Now, in the technical halachic sense, you have to deal with issues of ein kishri el ledaas, etc. So, in Inyanei Arayis, we usually assume that there is no concept of arayis, of onus. But in the Hasidic sphere, they quoted from the Tzidkas HaTzadik, Reb Tzadik HaKohen, that it is possible that the Yetzer Hara could be so strong and intense that Ma Yasa Ben Velo Yecheta. And that's really what they're getting at. In other words, maybe on a technical halachic issue it's not an onus, but our approach to that person, and for that person, obviously the person can never say, I'm an onus and therefore I should do something. Chas v'cholila. No one's saying that. But from the perspective of others and judging them, we should be judging them as if they are compulsed. Because they don't have full... They don't have say. They don't have the ability, the wherewithal. Our perspective should be that they can't really withstand the pressure. In Dr. Lamb's updated article, he responds to Rabbi Freundel, who contended that the approach that we take to homosexuals should be one of a mumar l'tei avon, rather than the approach of an ones. And it could be that yesh v'yesh. It could be they're talking about two different types. A mumar l'tei avon, Rashi in Avodah Zarah explains, is a person who has two pieces of meat in front of him, and the person chooses, right? The person, or I should say it like this. A mumar l'tei avon means a person who only has treif meat in front of them and chooses to eat the treif meat as an act of taiva. That means that theoretically the person could withstand, but right now the person can't. If you have a person who could never have any other outlet, so such a person might be categorized as an ones rather than mumar l'tei avon. That's why Dr. Lamb responds to Rabbi Freundel's critique. In the Dr. Lamb article, he quotes some interesting tshuvas. Rav Kook has a tshuva about a shochet who they found to be to have engaged in mishkav zachar. Can they have the fellow serve as a shochet? Rav Kook exonerates the fellow and allows him to continue serving as a shochet based on the lack of complete evidence for what he did. It would sound like such a person who engaged in an avera, according to Rav Kook, should not be appointed to a position as a shochet. Rabbi Lamb, in his shiur, mentioned that he would not accept someone to smicha knowing that the fellow is a homosexual. That, I think, requires a lot of thought. Obviously, I've never had to make these decisions. Rabbi Lamb's argument was that the person can't possibly be a role model. Can't possibly be a role model for the community. I think that requires a lot of thought. But certainly the source of Rav Kook saying that a position of communal leadership as a shochet should not be given is part of the equation when it comes to making these decisions. There's a lot to be said about this article. I encourage you again to read Rabbi Lamb's article and to discuss it with your Rebbeim and to try to come up with your own approach. This is a killer of an issue that, again, maybe you'll all be zochet to have nice communities in the suburbs where everyone is Shomer Torah mitzvahs completely and they send their kids to yeshivas and everyone is like married or trying to get married, and like, but it's highly, highly unlikely. Lamaisa, they contend that around 10% of the population is homosexual to a certain degree. Probably 3% is genuinely homosexual, the way Rabbi Lamb would define it. So in all likelihood, you will be confronting these issues, and just please avail yourselves of the opportunity to come up with a mahalach before you leave yeshiva. If there are any questions, maybe we could take them, and then we'll daven mincha. Yeah, Emmanuel.
So I understand that, let's say, like, there was somebody who was like lahachis, like that sort of a person, not to press and get an aliyah, things of that nature. But it seemed from the story that Rabbi Lamb was describing them, like, I mean, it just seems to me that, like, there are people that are just lahachis just for stop, but there are people that are lahachis because they've had really their life really difficult for them. So,
right. So the feeling is that if somebody is out to set an agenda for an entire community, that person is in the lahachis category. Whatever the motivations that got the person to that point, but right now, just to maintain the community, hard decisions have to be made.
No, I was...
Maybe we'll discuss this. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for coming, and we'll have a mincha downstairs. Just this.